The following programming is sponsored by the law firm of Soloff & Zervanus. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
All right, ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Soloff & Zervanus show here on WWDB Talk 860. This is what we would call a post-election special. I'm here with our host, John Zervanus. John, how are you, sir?
Hi, Joe. I'm fine. Thank you.
And you and I had the pleasure of having Governor-elect Josh Shapiro on the program about a month ago. And having said that, we're going to air. It's a 15-minute interview, so whatever you do, ladies and gentlemen, stick around because the last 15 minutes of the broadcast is going to be that that conversation between John Zervanus, myself, and Governor-elect Josh Shapiro. But having said that, and we actually did that broadcast before the election, and certainly it was an enlightening conversation with the Governor-elect, and he was a candidate at the time. John, obviously, you know, we've had our, you know, the election is completed, fortunately, and I'm pretty sure that it was our interview to put him over the top, or at least that's our version. Certainly Josh Shapiro won and Fetterman, John Fetterman also won, and so much to talk about, you know, those were the two primary, seats that we were looking at, obviously in this state, but so much more going on. Talk about your impressions of Josh Shapiro and his race, and certainly with a far right extreme candidate, you know, that he was running against, and of course it was successful.
Well, obviously, I think a lot of folks, especially. The trial bar, anybody who's interested in seeing social justice and civil justice move in a positive direction and move forward had to be thrilled with the election. And one of the things that was so impressive about Josh Shapiro, and I don't know if you saw his rally with President Obama, I think Biden was there, and I think it was here in Philadelphia at the time, and I forget where it was. It was a rally. I don't know if it was up at Temple or I don't know where it was, but he gave a rally speech where he kind of itemized the issues that were related to freedom, and he spoke of the Republican Party, and particularly the candidate that he was opposed, and identified, if you're for freedom, because the Republicans advertise themselves as promoting freedom, religious freedom, and that's fine. But when it came down to the issues, and this is reflected in state elections all over the country, Michigan in particular, but the freedom to control what's going on in your own body. And that resonated loudly. And I think that the state heard him. Freedom to marry who you want to marry. Freedom to organize if you want to join a labor union or not. The list goes on and on and on, where his opponent was against each and every one of these freedoms. So if you're going to talk about freedom, you almost have to take a second look at the Democrats and what they really stood for. And it was almost as though they were looking to preserve the status quo. It's like we have all these freedoms that we're entitled to, that we cherish. Each one of us as Americans expect to wake up in the morning and have them. And suddenly there's a party of extremists that are suggesting that you shouldn't have these freedoms anymore. And I think at the end of the day, the Republicans paid a steep price for that.
Absolutely.
Because if you look at a lot of the voters in the Republican Party, they cherish their freedom from government, their freedom to not be overburdened by taxes. And what's happened here is that party has become, okay, you know, we're going to stay out of your wallet, but we want to be in your bedroom, in your household, and we want to be able to dictate how you're going to run your personal life. And that is more revolting to an American that I think than getting hit with a tax bill.
It's interesting because it's some of the things that we talked about with Josh. Let's talk about that, okay? One of the things that I think backfired tremendously, and I'm sure I've said this on previous labor shows, and I don't know if you and I talked about it, but with the overturning of Roe versus Wade backfired heavily. Why? Because it ignited the base. Everybody, I knew as soon as it happened, especially when it went back to the states, okay, they at that point, now you're waking up people that were, you know.
Look what happened. I mean, a state like Kansas.
Yeah.
Kansas, who voted overwhelmingly for Republicans, came right out and said, no, we want our right to choose. And Michigan rolled back. They put it up as a referendum. And they said, no, we want our right to choose. And it's pretty obvious that the public wants their right to choose preserved.
Sure.
And if you tell anybody who gets up in the morning and decides how they're going to work and who they're going to work for, they want the right to decide that for themselves.
Exactly. And when we asked, when we talked to Josh, you and I, and we said, you know, what's on the line and some of the, especially as you know, I'm heavily involved in the labor movement. You know, you have your right, you know, to form a union, you know, like you mentioned. It's funny because they call it the right to work, but it's the exact opposite. And if you listen to Martin Luther King in some of his speeches, he talks about deceptive terms like right to work. Okay. And I had an energy show not long ago. I was doing a labor and energy show, and my guest said to me, and he's a national broadcaster. He's a talk radio host and an author. And he said to me, well, do you think that the unions will ever, you know, support Republican, you know, go Republican? That's what he, but unions, by the way, cannot, you know, we cannot just be, you know, we you're not just all Democrat. We support those who support us, obviously much more Democrat. But
in the last election,
right,
because of the whole America First concept,
right,
which was really, what do they call it, a wolf in sheep's clothing?
Yeah. Well, but what I'm saying, you're talking about Trump, and but the unions themselves did not back him. A lot of the members did.
Yeah, the members okay. did.
And you know they forgot that when you vote for president, you're voting for the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. and that's another issue. But the point is, here's what I said to guest we were talking about. I said, well, let me just say this. The Republican Party typically supports, or a lot of Republican candidates typically supports right to work. As long as that's happening and paycheck, so-called paycheck protection, that's never going to happen. And his answer was, because on issues of energy, which can be very complicated, there are some unions that work in refineries and a lot of different, so there are some issues that, you know, are you know, not just, you know, not just purely about labor, they're labor and energy. That, by the way, is the name of our show, the Labor and Energy Show that I do. But as long as Republicans typically support right to work and they're basically telling you, we're going to put you out of business. The candidate, as soon as he says that, okay, and in a sense, you know, you know. So those were again parts of the rights that were on the line. Women's rights, okay, workers' rights, you know, certainly. you know, a ton of other, you know, situations that, you know, people are just not going to sit around and wait and have their rights taken from them. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that speech was brilliant because I'm surprised it didn't really go viral because it was like he went through one right after another that his opponent, I mean, I can't speak for the whole party, but Mastriano himself was against each and every one of those. That's and when you went through the list, it was almost offensive. It was offensive that there would be a candidate there to tell you that, frankly, the ultimate offense was that he had a right, if he wasn't happy with the results of the election, that he could pull as governor, because he says he could, you know, the Constitution says they appoint the Secretary of State. So I guess through the Secretary of State, he could pull the voting machines, say, guess what, I don't like them.
Now, did you notice, I wasn't totally paying attention, but I noticed a lack of Mastriano's commercials in at the end of the...
He had no money.
Yeah, he...
Because the National Party didn't give him any, because they knew he wasn't a strong candidate. But he wasn't a good candidate.
He's an extremist.
It's a reflection of what Trump did to the party itself, and he's a drag on the party. Anybody who's taking a realistic approach, and you know, if you're a Democrat, you almost want him to run again.
Sure.
Because he creates such chaos within that party.
You're talking about Trump.
Yeah.
Well, he announced yesterday.
Well, he did, but it's a lukewarm response from the party.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like, yeah, okay, we're gonna have other candidates too, because they don't want to offend him. At the same time, he knows, because he's not getting the respect that he thinks he's entitled to, because he believes in his mind that he's made everybody in that party, but because he has 30-35% of that part of the constituents locked up, literally locked up, and they have a numbers problem. They have a numbers problem because if you don't include the MAGA crowd in their constituency, they don't have enough votes to win anything.
Hey, John, you know what's interesting? You can see, and I believe this, that the Democratic Party, you know, obviously there's a you know, far left faction that has been,
well, they're a problem too.
Yeah, right. They are, and you can see that the Democratic Party is coming back a little closer to the middle,
the adults in the room at this point.
That's right, and you know, I'll say this. When you talk about energy issues, and I happen to be heavily involved in them right now, you know, when it comes to the environment and all those things, you know, you would be surprised how many people, you know, energy executives and people who work at these big oil companies care about the environment and are working diligently, you know, to come up with solutions to bring down emissions, right?
I would be surprised.
You wouldn't, John. You wouldn't believe it, right?
Right.
I just had a guy by the name of John Bain on one of our broadcasts. He's with a company called EQT. EQT is the biggest natural gas producer in the country. They want to be at net zero by 2025. So.
Net zero as to
emissions.
Emissions, okay.
But my point to you is this, and education in that particular area. Fossil fuels and petrochemicals are in 5,000 to 6,000 products, including renewables that we use every day. There has to be common sense approach and working together. We're going towards renewables, no question about it. Nobody's saying. I guess what I'm saying is, though, you're starting to see some of the more extreme, and it's just an area, positions come to the middle. And the thing about Donald Trump that you have your right wing. Well, you know, you have your right wing. Even Dr. Oz was sitting there saying, you know, either the far right and the far left are out of control.
He was trying to play the middle at the end because he realized, I'm in trouble. I can't be tracked with these people.
That's right. But what I'm saying is that people are sick and tired of the division, you know, and I think that with the Democratic Party coming, you know, towards the center, you know, still left to center, but the point I'm making is the extremism is getting less and less, and you know, Trump just keeps throwing gasoline on the fire, and people, in my opinion, are just fed up with the division in this country.
It's disgraceful. I mean, I heard Marjorie Taylor Greene say the other day, now that they're going to have a very, very slim majority, what, by 3 or 4 votes. I'm not sure if that's, if you're going to have the ability to do anything, but they're going to control all the committees. And she's indicating that we're going to start pursuing against Hunter Biden. Why, I don't know. It's a private legal matter. Let one of the U.S. attorneys take that on.
Sure.
And then we're going to run after Biden, excuse me. And it's like, are you there to legislate or are you there to score points?
Yeah.
And people are tired of that.
Yeah.
They're just tired of it.
Well, the division in the United States of America, you know, and by the way, politics in Washington, let's look at Fetterman for a second, okay? Yeah. He had a terrible debate. A lot of things went wrong, and they probably shouldn't. But one thing people don't understand, and I would, this is as simple as the day is long, okay? And I simplify things too much, but I'll just say this, okay? The politicians run for office. They have to get money from somewhere. Special interest groups, labor, trial lawyers, doesn't matter, okay? When you're given your money, when they get their money from the big campaigns, they have to be for or against, not in the middle. People are mostly in the middle, but you need money to run, so you get extreme views, and there's always going to be
that's where the fundraising is.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Where the passion is.
That's right.
And the passion's with the extreme.
That's right. But my point is, those who can balance the extremes and the constituents in a common sense way are the candidates that win. You look at politics in general, and people are running for office. John Fetterman, for example. If I'm a labor guy, now I have a buddy of mine who sends me a text. He's a far right Republican. I went to high school with him, right? And we kind of joke around with one another, but I don't see him all that much, and I certainly couldn't have that conversation. But he sends me this crazy message, about if I'm voting for Fetterman during a debate, right? What they don't understand, and this goes, Bob, by the way, for Democrats also, when Republicans.
Oh, tribalism is a problem.
Right, right. But, but my point is, John Fetterman could have been a corpse. And I don't mean that. I apologize to anybody who takes that the wrong way. I don't mean that. But the other guy's telling you he's going to take your living off of you. I don't care who, I don't care who the guy is, who the other guy is. I have to vote for him or more importantly, I got to vote against this guy on right here. And I'm going to go as a labor guy, I'm just being hypothetical because we all know people.
Look, you get it. I hear you. Look what's happening in Georgia. You can grab every Republican off the street. I mean, I loved Herschel Walker as a football player, but if we're going to all have an intellectually honest conversation, he's not the right candidate, okay, under any analysis. But there are going to be people that vote for him because they want to. Well, right now they can't get a Republican majority in the Senate, but if they can, they can do it. So that there's only a one vote difference, they're going to want that.
Well, yeah, but it's the same with Herschel Walker in a sense that if you're a Republican and you're against a Democrat, no matter who it is, even if the Republican is not a great candidate, you're voting at least against the other guy
because you want your agenda to go forward.
That's right. So people. So it's, I get a kick out of people, you see the memes and all that stuff and of Fetterman. But the point is people should understand, especially if you're going to run for office, that in many ways people are going to, they're going to make decisions based on your platform. And you can sit there and have a debate all you want. And you could, like I said, you could put a zombie there. But if the other guy who went to Harvard is sitting there telling you he's putting you out of business, then I'm voting for the zombie.
You mean like Ted Cruz? He went to Harvard.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's a very, it's a fascinating conversation.
But, what I find just... And I want to say something, but I want to get my point across.
Sure.
What I find so astonishing is the idea that you know, this I want my government to be small. I want the government to stay out of my life. I all of that stuff. And the irony of this election was the party that was going to stay out of your life.
Yeah.
Was the Democrats, which historically isn't usually the case, especially when it comes to financial issues. Because they're the big government spenders. They're the ones that are going to create, you know, all the government regulation, et cetera, because historically that's what they did. But for the first time in my lifetime, I saw a party that was now the party that was going to stay out of your life, where the Republican Party was getting into your life.
Yeah.
And it's just a recipe for disaster. If that's going to be your platform, you're going down with the ship.
Yeah, especially today. And I say that, you know, when it's funny how with the overturning of the Supreme Court with Roe versus Wade, how in a sense how things backfired and how you really don't know what someone's going to do, what's going to happen and how it's going to impact people. As soon as it happened, and after I got a day or two,
it was a huge windfall for the Democrats, no question about it.
So let's talk a little bit about you know, with Josh Shapiro's platform and you know why we were so impressed by him and why he got such a it made such an impact. One of the things you said, which I thought was really important, and you know you had two issues that you talked about guns and violence and all those things.
Well, crime is an issue nationally, and it's a problem. We can't run away from it.
That's right. And you know what I admired about that was you weren't just sitting there, you know, placating them. Okay, you were asking them questions, and we both know that Josh took on some hard issues, the Catholic Church, all those things, which is, you know, typical and Catholic. When I say Catholic Church, it's a big organization.
Well, he spearheaded the effort to prosecute the Catholic Church for decades of
molestations,
sexual molestations. And you have states right next to ours, like New Jersey and New York, where they extended the statute of limitations so that adult survivors could come and make claims for violations.
Sure.
When they were children. Because, you know, it's a known medical or accepted medical opinion by most experts that, you know, a lot of these sexual assaults and anybody who goes through habitual molestations oftentimes suppress them well into their adult years. Now, I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't explain it. I don't know why that happens, but that's a well-known phenomenon. So folks who are in their 30s and 40s have decided, I've been living with this forever. I'm embarrassed by what happened to me, but I want accountability. And they finally stand up and want to say something. But it, you know, in Pennsylvania, it's still too late.
Yeah.
Or in New Jersey, New York. Well, Shapiro wanted to change that, and he ran into some issues, not at his doing, but for other reasons that were out of his control. And that's something that still hasn't happened here in the state of Pennsylvania. I think that's an effort that'll be resurrected. But he took that on. He's taken on crime head first, and no one can accuse him of being soft on crime. I mean, you had so many police organizations in the state that backed him up, unlike what we have going on in this city, where the district attorney is now going to get impeached.
What does that mean?
Well, they're going. I didn't know this, and I plead ignorant here. I didn't know that the state legislators can impeach a local politician. I didn't know that, and I plead ignorant on that. And if you interrogate me on it, I'm gonna raise the white flag because I just don't know.
But what happens at that point?
I guess he's gonna get thrown out of office if they vote to impeach him.
Today it says he was
officially impeached
today. It's sort of right here.
I didn't see it.
It's actually, I'm looking at my phone right now, and it actually says right here, what you call it? Where are we at here? Okay, Philly District Attorney Larry Krasner impeached. That he was.
I don't know if it's like. You know, in the U.S., you know, if a president got impeached, the Republicans get a vote to impeach him, then the Senate has to vote to impeach him. And there's a trial in the Senate.
I think there may be a trial. I'm not sure. We'll find out tonight.
You know, but you saw what happened with Trump. There's a trial, and one of our Philadelphia attorneys here went down to Washington, and I think it was his lead defense counsel, in front of the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. Senate voted not to impeach him. And you know, even though he was impeached, he wasn't kicked out of office. He wasn't prosecuted.
Well, the House, they impeached him, and the Senate.
But the Senate then has whatever. They have to vote to impeach him, but they have a trial, I guess. And
by the way, I did several interviews with that particular lawyer. And I can,
who, Mike?
Yeah, Michael Vandeveen. Yeah. And we did talk about the difference between, you know, fighting for your client in front of a jury, and then of course in Washington D.C. in front of the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, listen, it is an extraordinary effort. I you know, I can't imagine, you know, getting a call from the president asking. I mean, that's an out of body experience as far as I'm concerned.
Right, and here's the thing, and I think Bruce Castor was the one that initially got.
Yeah, he was the one that got involved.
Right, and so, but ironically, you know, my thought process, and Michael took he took a lot there for that. And it was, you know, even the trial bar was.
Yeah, there are a lot of people. He took a lot of grief for it.
But my thought process, having said that, is that the president of the United States, no matter who he is, can't get a defense. Then we all got massive problems.
Oh, he was entitled to a defense, and he got one. You know, in the Senate, there wasn't enough votes in the Senate to convict him. So, you know.
And you're counting, as I said it to Michael, I said, as soon as you walked, obviously you must have been counting left and right. You know, so, I mean.
When you're 51 to 49 or whatever the hell it is, 50-50, and, it, you know, and you know, if you're somebody who's just been elected to this Congress, the country's screaming at you. There, if this country isn't 50-50, then I don't know what is. Because you got a slim majority for the Democrats in the Senate. As slim as it can be. I mean, one or two. I mean, it's not a tie anymore. And then look at the House. It's three or four. I've never seen it like that.
Right.
I mean, that should tell everybody we got to compromise. We should all get locked in a room, figure out what we can agree on, pass that, and then go to the stuff that we can't agree on and fight it out.
Absolutely.
But the country's screaming at our politicians saying, we want you to compromise. Enough with the extremists.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I really believe that you know, that is. I'm not saying it's a thing of the past, but I think that you know that.
I think it's dying.
Absolutely.
But I don't think it's a thing of the past. I still think we have to fight it off, because on the left, you got the wokers, and they're offensive. I mean, you don't want anybody to tell you, oh, that's a violation or that's a foul or watch what you say. What did you mean by that? And constantly correcting you with political correctness. Yeah. It's irritating. And frankly, you know, people are taking a lot of things too seriously. You know, Bill Maher is one of my favorites on TV, and he's always involved in discussing politics and what's going on. And that guy's a card carrying liberal Democrat.
Yeah,
I mean, and he slams wokers.
He does.
Slams them.
He does.
And I agree with everything he says.
But interesting though, because I remember when I first started seeing it, I thought, am I missing something?
Yeah, no, he has no tolerance for it.
He doesn't. And you know, so the divide in the country, you know, is in my opinion is largely due to the extreme right. And obviously, well, and then
on,
left.
Yeah, and on the right side, you have their extremism. And the problem with the right is, and you see Steve Bannon get on his little podcast or whatever the hell he has.
Sure.
I ask myself, who stuffed him in lockers all his life?
Right.
That guy is the most angry human being I've ever seen. I mean, it's like, what are you so angry about? And he promotes violence.
Yeah.
You know, and this violence that occurred, We could never, ever have that again.
Well, no question about it, but also this, the conspiracy theories are, I mean, literally, and I'm telling you, John.
Well, that woman in Arizona had it handed to her. Carrie Lake had it handed to her.
Exactly, but at the same time, once they go down that rabbit hole, there's no coming back.
Yeah, you're done with that. Yeah. People don't want to hear that anymore. That added 15 minutes of fame, and that's like, okay, done with that.
Oh, yeah, no, let me say this, but that is a part of that problem on the right, and then, of course, the extreme left. Let me, in your particular area, okay, as a trial lawyer,
yeah.
One of the things I love about the trial lawyers, and I've said it 100 times because I advocate on behalf of injured workers, and I heavily advocate on behalf of individuals injured in auto accidents, and when I heavily advocate on I think there should be auto insurance reform, and I think that there should be all kinds of things because it's set up to hurt people like there's no tomorrow, but they do a better job at promoting than we do. Okay, so you know when I think about,
you mean messaging?
Yeah. So in other words, they're always talking about like regular people are fraud, and they start off trying to deceive people when they get in a car accident. You talk about auto insurance and those things where the Rogers rate and all that. You never hear anybody educate anybody about uninsured and underinsured motorists.
Well, remember, I can respond to that, and this is my response. Remember way back about 20 years ago when they wanted tort reform, especially for medical liability?
Yeah.
But the argument was, we need tort reform because of all these fraudulent lawsuits.
Yeah.
And here I am, a lawyer, a practicing trial lawyer, and I'm sitting there listening to this, and I'm like, where are all the fraudulent what fraudulent lawsuits? I mean, you get a fraudulent those cases are thrown out.
Right now you need to be certified
the biggest fraudulent lawsuit was? Rudy Giuliani arguing fraudulent elections in federal court at the last election, and every single federal judge that he went before, who were all Republican appointees, by the way, all said, where's the evidence? Where's the proof? You filed this thing, and you don't have a single scintilla of proof. That's the definition of fraud.
Right. Well, you know what's funny? And I'll bring his name up. Sam Pond has talked about fraud. He said he's been doing it decades and decades and decades. And he said he's never had a client brought up on fraud, but he's had many insurance companies brought up on fraud.
I can tell you this. In my fee agreement, okay, I have a paragraph saying, you are swearing to me that everything you're telling me is true, because I don't want to be a victim of your lie.
Oh,
And I can tell you that in all my years of practice, I did have a client lie to me. And unfortunately for me, I didn't find out about the deception until very late in the game. And, you know, I dropped them like a hot potato. You know, lawyers can be victims of that, but
sure,
it's our responsibility to weed out the fraud and weed out the people that are trying to do this to make money.
Well, let me say this. So when I think about, I watch the ball games, and it just goes right through me when I see about the Rogers rate and all these flow and all the, you know, and I say that because you don't hear them talking about uninsured, underinsured, and uninsured motorists. You also don't.
Well, no one knows what that means.
Well, you don't see Flo talking about it.
They don't want you to. Because the insurance companies don't want you to buy uninsured, underinsured motorist protection. Because if you have an accident, the person that hits you, especially in Philadelphia, is usually uninsured or grossly underinsured. If you don't have that coverage, you're not going to get compensated. The carriers in Philly are writing policies here in Philadelphia. They don't want to sell it.
Exactly. So my point to you is this, John. What I love about the trial lawyers is right now, if it was up to the right.
You love us because we speak the truth.
Yeah, but also you're out there. Guess what?
We're fighting the fight, man.
I guess, and we only have 10 minutes before we do Josh Shapiro's interview. We air that. Yeah. But I remember doctors came to me one time and they wanted to utilize some of our relationships, the legislation coming, and they were going in to see state reps, and they were getting thrown out. They had no, The trial lawyers are organized. You're fighting for legislation on behalf of people who don't even know they need it yet. They're not even injured. Yeah. So let me give you an example, which is an easy one. Workers' compensation. You can have it. The grand bargain back in, 1908 when they, you and I were there. We were at the table, right? but my point is the grand bargain trades the ability to sue your company for workers' comp insurance. And that's great. You have, you get to have workers' comp insurance and you're protected on the job. And then they keep constantly trying to gut the insurance companies backed by the right-wing politicians, trying to gut the medical. Okay, so you can have it, but our doctors are the one who are going to control it. And they're going to say, coincidentally, 85% of the time, and that's not an extreme, that you're not injured.
Think about that for a second.
Pip, you get $5,000.
We're just in the comps today, and I don't do much workers' comp, but you got a scenario where you get hurt on the job, you have to go to their doctors, period, in the beginning. And if those doctors decide
that you're not hurt,
if those doctors decide that, you still are hurt, you need treatment, then you get to choose your own doctor.
Right. Oh, right.
You don't have to keep them anymore.
Right.
But there's a certain period of time, and I forgive me, I don't know the timeline anymore.
It's 90 days.
90
if they abide by the regulations.
Yeah, but at some point, they can decide. It's still a stacked deck.
Yeah, of course.
It's still a stacked deck.
Well, John, talk about, since we have about 9 minutes, talk about what was on the line for the trial lawyers in the gubernatorial and, the Senate race.
Well, one thing that it may not have been such an issue here, but it was like behind the scenes. They were going to try to create, in Pennsylvania, you've got a Supreme Court here. And it's a statewide election. And, the state can pick, when you have a state Supreme Court election, it's decided by the folks in Pennsylvania. But because most of the voting block, most people live in the Philadelphia metropolitan area and the Pittsburgh metropolitan area, you have a better chance of getting a more Democrat-oriented, because these are elected officials that are appointed. More of a Democrat or a what I call a consumer protected oriented judge who's looking out for the little guy. All right. There was some behind the scenes efforts to create a situation where each area of Pennsylvania had the opportunity to select a judge so that you would have regionally selected judges, which was just a gross mischaracterization of the way statewide elections should work.
Exactly.
And, of course, we defeated that. Unfortunately, that never even came up to a vote. But that was a serious, serious concern for trial lawyers because it was a serious concern for the rest of the country. Imagine having a Philly judge on the Supreme Court or a Philly-oriented judge or somebody that came from that background or Pittsburgh. But then you've got dedicated judges to the middle part of the state or whatever.
Well, it doesn't.
It's just crazy.
It doesn't allow you to pick the best candidate. You're getting stuck by if they don't have if Philly or Reading or some area doesn't have a qualified candidate, but you got to pick one anyway.
Yeah, you got to pick one from this group because this is your judge. So now you got judges who are going to be committed to certain parts of the state versus other parts of the state. It was the most crazy a proposal I've ever seen. And thank God it didn't happen because there have been a lot of unhappy campers in this state.
Absolutely.
And that's not the way it works here.
So John, listen, we only got a minute. Okay. And we do have, we do have the interview with Josh Shapiro. Right. Talk about, that interview for a minute and what your impressions were going into the election and your sentiments since, Josh overwhelmingly won.
Yeah, I'm obviously we're thrilled. He's a fantastic candidate. He's going to be a fantastic governor. He's for the people. He's going to be an advocate for everyone in this state. Everyone. He doesn't have allegiances to anybody. In fact, in my conversations with him, maybe not one-on-one, but in groups that I've been in a closed rooms with him, he doesn't stand there and suggest in any way, shape, or form, regardless of his audience, you know, who he's going to be leaning with one way or the other. And it, because of that, the Pennsylvania electorate and the people that live here are going to be in for a treat, because he's going to do a good job.
Well said. You know, your sentiments mirror my own. You know, I want, you know, people stick around. You're going to really enjoy this conversation between John Zervanos, myself, and Governor-elect. He was a candidate when we did the interview, Josh Shapiro. And certainly, you know, you'll learn why he is going to be our next governor. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Soloff and Zervanos show. On behalf of our host, John Zervanos, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the interview with Governor-elect Josh Shapiro.
Soloff and Zervanos has your back. If you or someone you know is the victim of physical or sexual abuse or assault by an individual or individuals as a result of the negligence or fault of an organization who may have allowed it to occur, please understand that you are not alone and justice could be but one comforting and confidential phone call away. Please contact the law firm Soloff and Zervanos at 215-608-4067 if you, a loved one, or someone you know is the victim of physical or sexual abuse or assault by an individual or individuals as the result of negligence of an organization, and let their comforting, discreet, and understanding attorneys seek the justice you deserve. Again, contact the law firm Soloff and Zervanos at 215-608-4067 and let them seek the justice you deserve. Soloff and Zervanos, they have your back.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, around the Delaware Valley, this is Joe Dougherty. Welcome to a special edition of The Labor Show as we welcome Democratic gubernatorial candidate and the next governor of the state of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, to the broadcast. Josh, how are you, sir?
Hello, Joe. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's our pleasure, and we really want to thank you because I know you took time out of your very busy schedule. And we're getting down to the home stretch now. We're all excited about what's about to happen. I also want to welcome my co-host and our sponsor, John Zervanos of the law firm of Soloff and Zervanos, also a member of the Philadelphia Trials Association and the PA Association of Justice, big supporters of our next governor. So welcome to the broadcast, John.
Thank you, Joe. Pleasure to be here.
So it's great
to
have you.
Good to be with you. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So having said that, I'd like to start off, Josh, you know, a labor question. If you will, start off by talking about your commitment to working families and protecting the right to organize, as well as your commitment to creating good paying union jobs, which will certainly be all in jeopardy if your opponent has his way.
Look, my commitment runs long and deep. Y'all know I've been there for organized labor. As Attorney General, I started the first ever fair labor section because I thought workers were getting screwed in Pennsylvania, and I wanted to have their backs and make sure that under the law we were able to protect them. I've been proud to, you know, take on the federal government to protect, you know, the tips for waiters, waitresses, bartenders. I was proud to prosecute the largest Davis-Bacon prevailing wage theft case in the history of the United States of America here in Pennsylvania. We won that case, filed criminal charges, and got all $21 million back to Pennsylvania workers who had gotten ripped off. We've been really proud to lead the way and having workers back. So as AG, I've been in a position to protect union rights. As governor, I want to expand union rights. I want to make sure that more Pennsylvanians have the opportunity to join a union. I want to invest more in union apprenticeship programs so we can fill the jobs we need of tomorrow with more welders and electricians and plumbers, you name it. We have got to focus on expanding that base, expanding those number of workers, because that's what's going to help grow our economy. You know, union women and men help build this Commonwealth, and we need to make sure we have their backs and strengthen their hand so that it, in turn, it strengthens all of us.
Absolutely. And certainly our collective bargaining rights are at the right. You're doing this, you talk about what's on the line, the ability to collectively bargain. So
Without question. Now, I was going to say, Joe, without question, I mean, that is a central issue in this campaign. I will always oppose right to work. This will never be a right to work state so long as I'm governor. Yet my opponent is out every day campaigning on making this a right to work state, campaigning on the idea of shutting unions down and taking away your rights. It's an area where we have a profound disagreement. And listen, Joe, this isn't some theoretical thing. We know that this legislature will put a bill on the desk of the next governor to basically outlaw unions by making this a right to work state. I'll veto that bill. My opponent will sign it. And again, this will never be a right to work state so long as I'm governor.
Absolutely. And that's when we talk, we say it's the most important election in our lifetime. That's what's on the line. What I'd like to do, because we're in a sense spit firing here, go to John Zervanos, because we're going to talk about another topic that's obviously near and dear to your heart, Josh, and that is crime and your commitment. John, if you will.
Sure. Josh, as the Attorney General, you've always taken on the tough cases successfully, such as what you've done with the Catholic Church abuse cases. As governor, talk about your commitment to fighting crime and keeping citizens of Pennsylvania safe during a time when crime, particularly gun violence, is so high in so many of our urban areas, and particularly in Philadelphia, where I live.
Hey, John, listen, the level of crime is unacceptable, period. People have a right to be safe in their communities. They also have a right to feel safe in their communities. As Attorney General, and granted, we don't have the level of jurisdiction that every DA and local law enforcement have, but we are able to help complement some of the work that's being done when we have jurisdiction. So let me quickly rattle off our record. As AG, I've arrested 8,200 drug dealers during my time in office, almost 500 gun traffickers, over 500 child predators in our communities. Hell, we've even arrested over 100 corrupt public officials of both parties. I'll take a backseat to no one on that. There couldn't be a clearer contrast. My opponent literally didn't follow police orders on January the 6th when he was part of the mob who stormed the Capitol. And, we know that on that day and days after, police died as a result of that mob, and yet my opponent sided with the mob instead of law enforcement. I think, my track record combined with just how unfit for office my opponent is a reason why local police have endorsed me all across Pennsylvania. It's why they're backing me. I'm proud to be backed by the FOPs. I'm proud to be backed by the state troopers. I'm proud to be backed by prosecutors across Pennsylvania. By the way, John, of both parties, Republican and Democrat and independent. So the support we have in law enforcement runs deep, and I'll continue to have their backs. As governor, I want to make some strategic investments to help make our community safer. For example, I've talked throughout this whole campaign about the need to hire 2,000 more police officers in Pennsylvania. It's critical that we have properly trained police in our communities. That's really, really vital. And then we also have to invest in some of the underlying issues that are driving violence in our community, a lack of education, workforce opportunities, mental health. Those investments are really important as well.
John, you wanted to ask a question. We're going to finish up with an educational question, but John, you wanted to ask Josh a question about the rift sometimes between the urban and the rural areas.
This is something that I see nationally. You see it on all the national talk shows, Morning Joe, and places where everybody gets very intellectual about the issues. But I try cases all over the state. And I just want you to address, if you will, the growing rift between what I see. They call it two Americas, but I see it as a rift between rural America and urban America, and particularly in Pennsylvania, which is Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and the rest of the state, particularly the areas between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, which are deeply, deeply red. How do we bring this state together? What's your plans to bring this state together?
You know, John, I think a lot about that. And, you know, of course, I'm fanatical in how much I travel and get across the state. You know how hard I work. And yep. I'm in these rural communities and urban and suburban communities all the time. This weekend's a great example. I'll be all over the place as I am typically. And I guess, you know, I have to push back respectfully on you a little bit. And obviously, you know, I say this sure. with respect.
Go right ahead.
I don't sort of feel that rift when I'm out there. Maybe some of the ways it's portrayed in the media or online there is, but I actually see a lot of common humanity when I travel around. I'll give you a few examples. Like, you know, there's a problem getting connected to the internet at high speed, affordable rates in some very white rural communities in Pennsylvania, as well as in some, you know, urban communities in Pennsylvania. You know, these neighborhoods look really different. The folks who live there look different, but they have a common problem. They can't connect to high-speed, affordable internet, which makes it harder for them to for their kids to learn, harder for them to run their small business or their farm, harder for them to get good healthcare outcomes. It's also true that when it comes to workforce development, we're failing to make important investments in urban and rural communities. Same thing goes for healthcare. We've got a lack of healthcare access in parts of North Philly, along with parts of North Versailles in Pennsylvania. So there are areas that look really different, but they got common problems. And so for me, solving those problems will also help us create a new political dynamic in Pennsylvania that will actually bring people together, actually will help us see the humanity in one another, our common humanity. So I just think it's really important that we help people understand one another better through our common set of challenges. And I want to be a governor for all Pennsylvanians, no matter where you live or what you look like, you know, who you love, who you pray to. I want to make sure that I can be a governor that lifts everybody up. And in that process, hopefully repair our politics.
And Josh, on that line, education and investing in education is important to you. Talk about your plan to invest in education, including one thing you elaborated earlier, investing in vo-tech and apprenticeships, because as we know, a lot of our children are headed to college and others are potentially seeking a career in the trades. Talk about that.
I just think it's important that we not only write a check to a school district, which we have to invest in our schools. There's no question. But you just got to make sure that we're kind of refocusing people's minds around the creation of opportunity, right? So like if you're in the 10th grade, you should be able to have a mental health counselor, for example, in your school building to help make sure you're healthy. You should be going to a school that's healthy to be in, right? And you should also be in a place where you can learn a trade. And listen, let's be honest, it's not going to be for everybody. But if you're turned on by the idea of being a welder, we shouldn't force you to go take on a bunch of college debt before you get to that apprenticeship program. We should help you get right into that apprenticeship program, the union apprenticeship program, funded in part through the Commonwealth. That is going to help us, you know, create the jobs we need of tomorrow and, you know, help a lot of young people find direction in their lives. And by the way, a good byproduct of that, back to your question about crime before, is it's going to help create safer communities. So I think it's just really important to invest in our schools, but to make them focused on the creation of opportunity. That's what really matters.
Absolutely. And so we know that your time is short and we appreciate you being here. One final question that John and I put together. Yeah, people talk about the most important election in your lifetime and all those things. But in this situation, that is not an understatement. And this is and this is about getting the vote out. If you would, as you leave us, tell our listeners what's on the line when it comes to this particular election.
Look, it's all on the line. I mean, I'm running against by far the most extreme and dangerous candidate to ever run for governor in Pennsylvania, and probably by far the most extreme and dangerous running in the nation right now. He's someone who wants to take away our freedoms, whether it's the right of women to be able to make decisions over their own bodies, or the right of people to be able to join a union.
Yep.
Your right to vote. It's all on the line. And this guy keeps saying the quiet part out loud about how he wants to take away your vote, take away your freedoms. And I'm not going to stand for that. Listen, guys, my name may be on the ballot, but it's your rights and your future that's on the line right now. It's the future of organized labor. It's the future of women. It's the future of all of us if my opponent is able to take away your right to vote. Our right to vote is the foundational force in our democracy. It's your power, and he wants to take it away. So we got to mobilize and organize over these next several days here before the election. We got to make sure we get out and vote. And we got to recognize that we have the power here to push back on Doug Mastriano's dangerous extremism and instead elect me, someone who's always going to have the backs of organized labor, someone who's going to invest in workforce development, create jobs, and create a stronger economy.
And that was exactly, you know, what where I was going. Our workers' rights, our women's rights, our right to vote, our basic freedoms. That is not an understatement. And so having said that, Attorney General Josh Shapiro, we want to thank you so much for joining us on a special edition of the Labor Show. We will be out there in droves for you on election. Keep doing what you're doing. On behalf of John Zervanos, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.